listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Venezuela's Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza was back at the UN this past Tuesday, and he held a press conference about the situation facing his country from the continuing U.S. effort to force regime change there.
Thank you for your attendance. We come from an extraordinary meeting with the Coordinator Bureau of the Non-Aligned Movement countries. We were there from 10 o'clock in the morning till almost 1, 12:30. So this is throughout about almost 3 hours of meetings. So not only do they express solidarity with Venezuela, but also respect for international law in the house and the temple of international law and civilized law. Here we have the Charter of the United Nations, which underpins this, the non-interference in internal affairs, respect of sovereignty. So this is opposition to the threat, or rather the threat of use of force against Venezuela in this case. So we're very pleased with the trip last night, and we met with Secretary General Antonio Guterres. We had a long meeting with him as well, very interesting. We're talking about deepening cooperation between the United Nations and Venezuela in those areas of the economy where it was very impacted by this international assault or aggression led by Washington. The goal here is to raise our cooperation to a new level with United Nations agencies. And this week, it's starting right here with our mission with specific projects of technical assistance, also in Caracas, working with the UN system, the UN system agencies that are present in Caracas. I'd like to start here by saying, as you know, President Maduro openly denounced the fact that this process of a coup d'etat in Venezuela, for the very first time in Latin America history, we see a coup being led by and openly led by the government of the United States. It's not like what we've seen in the past, where they were always there in the background, moving the pieces around the chessboard or financing things, but with a certain amount of dissimulation. They were doing it in a more covert manner. Their position was much less evident, that it wasn't obvious that they were at the helm of the operation. And then many years later, documents were produced with the CIA or security agencies of the United States, intelligence agencies. Then when those documents are declassified, there was evidence that the United States was always behind the various interventions and invasions, of course, and the coup d'etats in our government, overthrowing the governments in our continent. And now here we see Mr. Pence, Mr. Trump, Bolton, Pompeo, members of Congress, extremists, etc., all involved. But now here we see that this can happen any day. But the chapter of overthrowing the government of today and its leaders from a movement led by the United States and its government. John Bolton tweeted about it. And others says, and in English,
report Maduro's theft of Venezuelan resources will not be forgotten. The United States will continue to use all of its powers to preserve the Venezuelan people's assets, and we encourage all nations to work together to do the same. Y está tuiteando.
And then he's tweeting that there's news. Here we have our Minister of Oil, Manuel Querero, and an agreement that we secured with, India. We've been working with India since a lot of Venezuelan oil was coming from this to the States, but since they assaulted us and they've stolen from us, they stole our company. This is a business. Some Citgo, some 30 million Venezuelan. Many of you probably filled up your gas tanks with Venezuelan gas, violating the laws, in breach of business and corporate law in the United States, because it's a private American company. It's a holding, and it also belongs to Venezuela Petroleum Company. And I think even the legal justification for this kind of investment in the United States was fairly weak. It's almost a communist approach, the approach taken by this government in the United States. But for those who don't really understand what he's saying here in this tweet, Mr. Bolton is saying that the companies that support Maduro's theft of Venezuelan resources will not be forgotten. Underscore the threat here, will not be forgotten. All of the powers of the government, of the most powerful government of this planet, will be used to preserve the assets of the Venezuelan people, and we encourage all nations to work together to do the same. So what he's trying to do here is give orders. This is a dictatorship that they're trying to impose on the world, unilateralism and its maximum expression. And that's why in the meeting of non-aligned movements just a few minutes ago, there was a rebellion against this dictatorship, a defense of multilateralism, a defense of the United Nations Charter, of the principles and purposes enshrined in the Charter, and of course, the principles of the non-aligned movement, the principle of Bandung, which, as you know, these principles emerged to moderate extremism, to stop war, prevent war, to impose law on the world, and so there would not be intervention, senseless intervention in others' affairs in the world. Now, this can happen in any day of the year. There are communications, speeches made, tweets, and concrete action taken. The United States was seeking a certain amount of momentum by giving orders and trying to support a sector of Venezuelan opposition. They were promoting a military coup. They financed it, encouraged it, supported it in every possible way. And the National Armed Forces of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela stood firm, monolithically, and they stood by this constitution, which is the constitution of the 30 million Venezuelan citizens. And as a result, with the commander-in-chief, and the constitution indicates that that is the president, elected by Venezuelans. men and women. That's why it's so important to have this conversation. It's so important to be able to answer questions, because enough is enough. Enough with the lies. We are here to defend a truth, the truth of Venezuela. We are a government made of human beings, a government which is flawed, but a government and a revolution which a very broad popular and people's support. We have laws, we have institutions. We have five powers in Venezuela. And the fact that the United States would have a plan to intervene in Venezuela, that's what it's doing. It's openly intervening. But even President Trump, 3 or 4 days ago, once again said, we will not discard the possibility of using military force against Venezuela. And then what happened with the United Nations Charter? Anything can happen here, and no reaction, right? Article 2 of the sacred charter for us to achieve the goals enshrined in Article 1, the members will proceed according to the following principles. The fourth principle says, members of the organization will refrain from resorting to the threat of the use of force or the use of force attacking the territorial integrity, independence of any state, or anything that is incompatible with the purposes of the United Nations. You can't be clearer than that. So, as we were saying, we've come to New York and we've met with a number of people, and we'll continue to meet with permanent representatives of a number of different nations. Last night we were sharing in the reception celebrating 40 years of the very admirable Islamic Revolution of Iran. We were there at the reception and shared with a number of our colleagues there, and we will continue. And of course, as we were saying, we will continue holding firm. Venezuela wants to deepen its cooperation with the United Nations because President Nicolas Maduro has assumed a new presidential mandate, started a new term in January. On a Saturday, we were meeting with the UN country team in Caracas because we believe in the United Nations, because we believe in multilateralism. And when there are fascist outbreaks or outbreaks of those who were vanquished in the Second World War by the people, outbreaks of what we see what emerged from the victory of mankind, with this institution emerged from the rubbles of the war. And now what we need to do is strengthen the institution that emerged from that war and prevent the dictatorship that some would wish to impose on the world. And in Venezuela, on a smaller scale, we see that men and women are moving forward with their lives. So, welcome, and go ahead, please.
Por favor.
Thank you, Mr. Minister, for this press conference. My name is Valeria Robecco, and I'm with ANSA, the Italian News Web Service, and I'm the president of ANCA. So I thank you on behalf of ANCA for this press conference. Today, the Italian foreign minister said that the last elections in Venezuela have been illegal and new credible elections are needed, but at the same time didn't take positions on the leader of opposition, Guaido. Can you please comment on that? And also, how, in your opinion, the Italian government can help the Venezuelan people in this moment in the country? Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Look, any government has to respect this charter, it's logical, and at the same time has to respect the constitution, in this case the constitution of Venezuela, and call for dialogue between parties. And that's what any government has to do, any government that wishes to help Venezuela. The other thing is going to the US's side and being on the wrong side of history. We have said that it's a shame that the European Union and its institutions and the High Representative Federica Mogherini and many of the member states of the European Union, it's a shame that they took a wrong step by recognizing something that doesn't exist. And that is to say, a government that was self-proclaimed. And this is something that Europeans like a football metaphor. Well, they've been caught offside in this case. In this case, the government of Italy has been very mindful of the situation, and they wish there to be a Venezuelan sovereign solution to this situation and not to be imposing a solution, which is what the US government appears to want. We wish to see consistency. Thank you.
Gracias, Canciller.
Thank you very much, Foreign Minister. One question that has been heard is why is there not opened up a humanitarian pathway in Venezuela which would allow for humanitarian aid not to be politicized? You have spoken about accusations from the US, but we have heard that clearly humanitarian aid, there are people who are calling for humanitarian aid to come into the country freely. There are stories about a lack of food and medicine, and this is reports from the United Nations. In this visit, would you be willing yourself to call for a humanitarian pathway to open up? And perhaps this is something that the SG himself could call for to ensure that it can get through. Well, in fact, the Colombian media have been talking about a show in Venezuela. Since the executive decree was signed in 2015, they started to say that the intermediary bank couldn't be used, they didn't have access to international financing, and then formally in August 2017, with a cost which at a minimum in various studies, there are some that said it was even more, but at a minimum with the illegal confiscation went beyond even $30 billion. So a government that is threatening you with the use of force, threatening you with an evasion, with a blockade, that gives orders to other countries for them to block you, do they really want to provide you with humanitarian aid? Let's be serious. That would be quite absurd. This is a hostile government that's killing you, and then they want to help you out. That doesn't make any sense. So let's be consistent. If there's a blockade on Venezuela, well, you need to lift the sanctions, because the United Nations Charter doesn't give any legal authority to the US government to impose coercive unilateral measures outside international law. That is the truth, and that is the reality. And what is even more shameful is if we talk about $20 million in comparison to the billions of dollars, if you look at access to raw materials and access to the industrial park, well, let's not be so hypocritical in this conversation. There isn't a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. There is an economy in Venezuela that is subject to a blockade. We have been able to recover significant levels of consumption in Venezuela with adequate distribution of food, with hundreds of thousands of tons of food in Venezuela being distributed. So let us not give in to the show, CNN, Fox News. We're talking about a bridge on which the situation hasn't changed. This is a bridge that has never been open. Colombia never paid for their share of the bridge, and now they say, well, Maduro has closed the bridge. That's not true. So there's a great deal of cynicism and hypocrisy in the media and in the world. But let's be decent, and let's be rigorous, and let's respect truth, and not lead to generating the conditions for a military intervention in Venezuela. Thank you. Thank you very much, Foreign Minister. I'll be asking my question in English.
A settlement that you would see with Guaido or the opposition in which there would be new elections. And why do you think there are so many other countries other than the United States that are also calling for new elections? Okay. Thank you.
Muchas gracias. Miren.
Thank you. Well, look. This constitution is very rich. It's the most complete constitution. You know that we say that quite modestly. But not modestly. It's the most complete constitution in Latin America. It contemplates thousands of paths for political change. All the variations are here. We don't impose conditions for negotiations, and we never did last year in the Dominican Republic. They said, and I said to them, and the government of the United States, and as a result, the opposition, and then as a result of that, the governments of some European Union countries, they say, well, Maduro wants to talk to waste time. But the opposition of Venezuela made Venezuelans lose and waste time. They didn't respect the constitutional principles. They didn't want to continue forward. And they were actually quite satisfied when finally a date was set for the presidential elections for the following year. They said they wouldn't sign the agreement in Santo Domingo. The president was there. There was the cameras were all ready. We were very embarrassed by that. This is with the former president, Rodriguez Patero. The Venezuela delegation was there to sign the agreement. It was printed on paper. The lights were there. The cameras were there. Everybody was ready to click. And they were there with Rex Stevenson, Manuel Santos, who were all in Bogota. They were all there to sign the Santo Domingo Agreement. Why? To generate this whole situation. What they did was make us lose the agreement, make the world and the international community wasted time with this. They called us to sit down there, and it was the opposition in Venezuela that caused this situation. That's why Maduro, President Maduro, is insisting in Miraflores, in Caracas, in the national park of in Montevideo, Mexico City, Beijing, wherever you want, we'll sit down. And in 15 minutes, in 15 hours or 15 days, we're prepared to do that because we are a sovereign state. We are the Venezuelan people, and we have an independent opposition. And even the extremists pick up the phone and they get orders, and the first is Raul, then Bolton, then Pence, and then Trump. And they even have meetings in the White House. And they're going to introduce someone to us, and we have everything. They're supposedly refugees, enjoying the status of refugees with the Colombian government. There's all sorts of confusion, but let's not lose sight of the evidence. And the attempt of assassination of not just President Maduro, which is extremely serious, but also public powers last August in Venezuela. This is an opposition which is betting on civil war, on violence, and on a coup d'etat. Now, they are brothers and sisters, all of them, leaders, deputies, whoever. They are compatriots and brothers and sisters. So we have a duty to sit down with them. But there's a whole body there. There's a mechanism that was created, a mechanism created in Montevideo. It was created very carefully with a very clear methodology with neutral countries who were concerned about Venezuela's situation. We sat down and we called it the Montevideo mechanism. We can use that mechanism or the Caracas mechanism or the Constitution. Everything is possible. Yes, you in the back, please. AP agency. Minister, the Secretary General insisted on a number of occasions on his offering of good offices. And given that you're in favor of dialogue, have you looked at the possibility of sitting down with mediation with Guaido and the United Nations? Yes, says the minister in answering the question. One of the issues we looked at yesterday was the possibility of Venezuela transiting through dialogue between the parties and making policy, not coup d'etats or promoting invasions. The Secretary General said he was in favor of the mechanism of dialogue, be it the Montevideo mechanism or any other, to be used, and he's prepared to support the process in that regard. What's surprising to us is that Deputy Guaido and his people has paid so much attention to the government of the United States and Bolton, et cetera, saying there's no time for dialogue. What Maduro, and they're saying that Maduro just wants to get time on his side. But we need a necessary process of independence, decolonization. The opposition in Venezuela needs to decolonize. And most of the militants of the opposition in Venezuela, there are many millions of Venezuelans, are against any position that would weaken our sovereignty they want dialogue internally amongst us. So indeed, We're waiting. We're waiting for the opposition of Venezuela to deign to sit down with us. Yes, you, please.
State Global Research. Shortly after you were here speaking at the Security Council, the Wall Street Journal published an article saying that after the U.S., if it succeeds in changing your government, they will then go after the socialist government in Nicaragua and Cuba, which explained to me why Mr. Pompeo blamed Cuba for helping Venezuela. This would be, or do you think that this is an ideological assault to roll back socialist tendencies in Latin America and elsewhere, of course?
Thank you very much. In any case, Mr. Bolton has said that there is a troika of evil in Latin America, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, imposing ideology on it and going back to the worst times of the Cold War, the times of Nixon, McCarthy, and not respecting this charter because all the ideas are in the charter. That is why we need to strengthen the United Nations. We need to strengthen international institutions that do uphold international law and avoid the imperialist dictatorship of the United States. As Bolton has said, they want to get at the oil to make the most of Venezuela's oil. And this is something that President Trump has said. They want to get hold of the loot. And that's something that President Trump has said openly. It's pretty obvious because Venezuela has a great deal of resources, oil, minerals, and others. Given such an open, flagrant attempt, we think that there should be a reaction to avoid a war. And we have seen, for instance, we have seen that there are going to be demonstrations in front of the White House, in fact, to ensure that we avoid a situation where there would be bloodshed in Venezuela. And in fact, this is something that we've already seen. Suffering is something we've already seen because sanctions imposed by the US have already led to immense suffering. And if it goes further, then Donald Trump's hands would have blood on his hands. So that is why we want to avoid a coup d'etat. And we want to avoid any kind of intervention in Venezuela because it would only lead to an even worse situation, and it would be a situation akin to what happened in Vietnam. And that is why we saw that there has been a letter that has been signed by millions of people in Venezuela and Latin America and many people in the world, including in the United States, to ensure that it is the people, ultimately the sovereign people, of the United States, after all, who can stop the madness of Trump.
Microphone for the speaker, please.
James Bayes from Al Jazeera. It's pretty clear for you, I think, when you wander around the United Nations, that the members of the United Nations are divided. Some support your government, some don't. The members of the Security Council are divided. They are, though, united in trying to avoid violence. You yourself have just spoken about avoiding bloodshed. Will you make a pledge to us here and now that your government will not use any sort of crackdown, any sort of repression against peaceful protesters?
Madam.
Look, indeed, in the dictatorship that they're trying to impose on the world, there are those who are following the steps of the dictator and those that don't follow in those steps, those who are free, those that are not. We understand that. The dictatorship, the neo-imperialist colonial dictatorship, is managing to get support and sympathy, or as Bolton said today, either do it for the good reasons or the wrong ones. Follow my footsteps here. get ready. And it's unfortunate that some countries, especially the Europeans, we understand the ones in Latin America, these governments are entirely subordinate to Washington. It's like a big corporation with Trump as the CEO, and all the soldiers, the presidents of Latin America follow. They want to make sure that they get in the good favor of the CEO at the top, Trump. So we understand that. But in our country, there hasn't been repression since before the Bolivarian Revolution, when we were students. Jorge Reaza, President Nicolas Maduro, was a leader of the movements. There was repression and crackdown on a daily basis. Security forces were had been used by the United States government. A well-known Cuban-American terrorist was at the helm of the security forces at that time, the supposed democracy in Venezuela. So it was a daily occurrence. We had 4 months of political violence in the streets every single day. There was a structured plan in place calling for the various institutions to destroy this one, do this over here, 4 months. And what did President Nicolas Maduro do? Resolve with militarizations and crackdowns and repression? No. He was based on the constitution of our country, Article 8.4.3. The National Assembly on the 30th of July was constituted, and the next day there was no more violence, no more protests. The next violence occurred after the elections of the Legislative Assembly. There was burnings. They persecuted people, armed forces and the militia who were trying to protect the election. And despite the violence, the terror, despite the media and the calls of the United States government and Latin American governments, more than 8 million Venezuelan men and women went to vote despite all that. We have always sought solutions in Venezuela through democracy.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Worlds Apart. History, if we are to believe Mark Twain, doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. 30 years after the collapse of the Soviet system and the global changes it ushered in, it's hard not to see the transformations in the Western world in the same light. Could we now be witnessing the final act of the Cold War, 3 decades after everybody thought it was over? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Sergei Karaganov, Dean of the School of World Economy and International Relations, the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Mr. Karaganov, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you very much for granting us some time.
I'm happy to be with you.
Now, no historical parallel is perfect, but to my Russian eye, there are simply too many similarities between 1989 and 2019, because the Reagan men are now back in power in the United States. We're hearing a lot of talk about the systemic crisis and institutional paralysis of yet another union, this time European Union. You, of all people, must be having a feeling of déjà vu, don't you?
That is, of course, a repeat of the Cold War. And being a historian of the Cold War, I could endlessly talk about the parallels. By the way, the people who are now at the helm of the U.S. administrations are the old Cold Warriors of the Reagan era. And they repeat the recipes of the Reagan, one line by one line, which is extremely funny.
Do you think the Cold War finished back in the 90s?
Let's put it this way. Cold War was a period in history. We could have called the Cold War a situation in the 20s and 30s. That Cold War has finished. Yeah, but then it was not finished because it was not finished by a peace treaty and by a general understanding and a rapprochement between the former competitors. The One side decided that it had won. The other side never yields, Russia. And it fought back. In the meantime, because the other side believed that it won and forever, they believed that China would eventually become
like
them and join the West, which was an absolutely absurd idea.
Now, it may seem like a very stupid comparison, but I sometimes think that there is some things in common between Donald Trump and Mikhail Gorbachev and the way they call bluff on their own systems. For example, Gorbachev called it glasnost, for Trump it's Twitter, but aren't they ultimately doing the same thing?
No. Gorbachev didn't understand his system, and Gorbachev actually ended the system. I mean, Trump, and he's an enemy of my country because his country decided to be an enemy of my country, is trying to revamp his system, and he will succeed.
And does he understand his system well? Because the popular opinion of Trump is that he is an ignoramus who cannot string the two sentences together.
Of course, he doesn't understand anything, but he does not want to understand everything, especially he doesn't want to understand the prevailing liberal, quote-unquote, views of most of the elites, which failed bitterly. And he, for better or for worse, is returning to normalcy. But he's, of course, a very picturesque person. So, I mean, he says a lot of unbelievable things.
Well, let's not discuss his moral qualities or how he comes across. I mean, that's for the world, it's irrelevant.
He is moving the United States in the right direction from a point of view American. If I were an American, I would have moved in the same direction.
The more I learn about globalization and how it affects the American, specifically the American system, which is far more import-oriented than other economies, the more I wonder why didn't the American system produce somebody like him with that set of economic ideas before? Because if we look at the economic indicators, the shrinking of the middle class, trade deficit, employment data, etc., some sort of a backlash against globalization ought to have existed long before. Why did it take so long?
Even Obama, and it was a backlash already, came with a more or less, interestingly enough, the same ideas as Donald Trump.
He was
absolutely. I mean, he had a medical care, medical aid, which was very liberal. But other than that, resurrection of the United States, returning back American jobs, and cutting foreign involvement. That was his message, but the elite didn't permit him. And that's why the correction now is so hard.
And when you talk about the elites, do you mean political elites or the economic elites?
Both. Both a big part of the economic elite, which has become globalized and forgot the national interests of the United States. Sorry. And also the intellectual elite and the most of the, and a lot of political elite, but and most of the intellectual elite, which became enthralled by the idea of winning by the fact that everybody was listening to them. It was a pleasant time for them. Now it has finished.
Was it just this vanity that you described, or was it a real material interest in sustaining the system that allows the American economy to grow only for the very, very selected few?
No, it was a very important part of the United States, which benefited from that kind of globalization. But other America, the real America, the core America, suffered. And also some of the industries suffered, including, I'm sorry, military-industrial complex, which is now returning back. And they're turning some of the core industries, which are returning back. And they supported Mr. Trump. He is not a president of a middle class or low middle class. He's also a president of a very important part of U.S. elite.
In his latest State of the Union address, Trump railed against socialism and the new left politics. But I think if we look closely, we will see that the origins of that phenomenon, political phenomenon in the United States, has a lot of similarities with Trumpism, because ultimately I think it's also a response against an economic system which frees the wealth from any constraints by a nation state and any social responsibility. How do you see this battle between globalism and national economic nationalism playing out, with or without Trump?
They are changing. They are changing the balance, and it's a proper change of the balance. And in his statement to the Congress, which was amazing, by the way, I was enthralled. He's not my favorite, but he did well, and he was the winner. He exactly said what most of America, or majority of Americans, wanted.
Well, and it was very well received by the American public, even by the Democrats.
And that's why I mean, probably he will win, even in the medium term. But then he will be supplanted, and the pendulum will go back, and he and others would not need the animosity towards Russia, by the way, because they need it only for corralling the ruling class and the elite now.
Well, they're already starting to see that. I don't know if you saw the latest news. I think it was the Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee concluded that there was no hard evidence of Trump cooperating with the Russians in any way. That's all
absolutely falsified lies. Is it term nice enough? There's no truth in it. But there's a basic interest. They needed an enemy against whom to organize and whom to use against the elite. Whom to use against the Trump, who was not them. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm relatively optimistic medium term, because they will solve internal problems, including taking control over social media, which got free in the previous decade, and was one of the reasons why the old elite lost control over the political process.
So you seem to believe that the elites in the end will prevail. You think they will take back
the controls? They will be different. They will prevail. I'm sure, as they always prevailed in the history of the United States, except for Civil War in the 19th century. But they will change, and of course Trump will change them. And those elites which have been there for in 19 and the 2000s will be watered down or pushed aside.
I know that one of your professional interests is China, and the Trump administration very abruptly changed the American policy vis-a-vis China. And if we read people like Michael Pillsbury of the Hudson Institute, we can see that it's just the beginning. Do you think the Americans can really contain China at this point, economically contain it, or is it too little, too late to think about it?
No, it is not Trump. The anti-Chinese mood was there during Obama and during...
never acted on it.
Obama was Gorbachev. He was never ready to act. But the mood was there. Whether the United States will continue to the policy of harsh containment, for the time being, yes. Again, a few years from now, let us see. Because in the end, it is a losing game. Because as the game against Russia, it was seemingly victorious, because Soviet Union had to face West and they faced China, two enemies. Now Russia and China are together, and the world is absolutely different. So United States will have to fight a lone fight, and they're bound to lose eventually. But I don't want anybody to lose, because when somebody loses, there is a revanche, which is happening now. We are turning back.
I heard you say that this rivalry between China and the United States may offer Russia a unique capability of being the so-called free radical, having more room for maneuver than the other two. Don't you think that Moscow would have to have a much better relationship with Washington for that to happen?
First of all, China is and should be a close friend and semi-ally. But that doesn't mean that we should be absolutely linked to any Chinese policy. And 5 years from now, I believe that if United States get the census, there will be somewhat more of an opportunity for us to deal with them, We will not be anti-Chinese, as the Chinese were anti-Soviet in Kissinger's times, but we will have a lot of maneuver. And that is the basic idea of Russian foreign policy, is building the huge Eurasian partnership with bringing in parts of Europe, bringing in others, not necessarily anti-American. But Russia will be the northern Eurasia there, playing not only in the triangle Russia, China, United States, but also in several others. And look, we are watching a resurrection of old grand empires, and like Turkey, Iran, India. I mean, the Arab states are becoming more influential. The only part of our vicinity which is getting weak is Europe, but we
will
are
talk
European.
About that more in the second part. But you mentioned Kissinger, and I know that you are on friendly terms with him. The typical line in the United States is that Russia has played a poor hand relatively well. What is his genuine opinion of how well the United States plays its hand, both now and before?
I haven't heard. First of all, we're not friends, but have a lot of conversations. I've had a lot of conversations, and I believe he is the number one thinker in the world on foreign policy. Now, I think he is bitter.
Well, sometimes somebody being bitter makes you feel good.
Let's put it this way. I think that it is better to win with a bright man than to lose with a stupid man. The bright man in the United States and in the West are losing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Karaganov, we have to take a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Sergei Karaganov, Dean of the School of World Economy and International Relations at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Mr. Karaganov, we talked about the Americans. Let's switch our attention to the Europeans. Just a few days ago, George Soros wrote a big op-ed warning that the European Union was sleepwalking into oblivion, and explicitly compared the European leadership to the Soviet Politburo, issuing meaningless, non-executable orders. What do you make of this comparison between the EU and the USSR by George Soros, of all people?
Mr. Soros is an enemy of my country, but sometimes he makes good judgment.
You agree with him?
No, but he sometimes makes good judgments.
But more specifically about this metaphor that he makes, that the European Union has become almost a victim of its own success.
Let's put it this way. First of all, I mean, I'm not happy about the state of Europe, because it is pitiful, it is going down for the time being, but Russia culturally is Europe. And we need Europe as a partner and even as a counterbalance in a big game which we are entering of in the 21st century. So saying that, it's not only a success. These were also very bitter mistakes brought about by ideological mistakes and beliefs.
I heard you say before that, contrary to popular opinion, the Americans, the way they act is understandable and predictable from the Russian point of view, but the European behavior is inexplicable when you think about the European interest. Can you elaborate more on that? What do you mean?
I understand. I could not vilify Europeans because they have made, so many terrible mistakes and broke one of the greatest embodiments of international relations in human history. European Union would have been a great city on the hill if it were to survive. I don't think it will. Europeans, unfortunately, have been victimized by 70 years of not thinking not working hard, and also relying on somebody else. They have been relying on insecurity and political terms, either on the Soviet Union, by the way, or on the United States, and they are now totally unprepared for the new world.
We still try to reach out to the Europeans, and there are some signs that, for example, Germany, in some ways reciprocating. I'm sure you've been heard many times about this recent news about Germany's success in fighting off attacks on the Nord Stream pipeline. Is that not an example of Europe developing more muscle to, or at least Germany developing more muscles to stand for itself?
I don't think they are developing more muscle, but I think they are coming to senses. And I hope that in several years, now we will have a new rapprochement, but an absolutely different basis. It is not Russia integrating with Europe. It will be probably Europe, Russia, and Asian countries building together something kind of a new, larger Eurasian unity. I mean, Russia is a very senior member, incomparably stronger than Europe.
Well, that's a very bold statement.
It is not a statement. It is.
But economically, you would agree that Russia is still suffering, and you are one of the people who is very vocal about it.
We are suffering. We are not very effective for all kind of reasons. But in cumulative power, we are probably twice as strong as Europe. I mean, Europe is not even counted in the calculations of world powers. Now, which is, by the way, unbelievable mistake of European friends.
And it's not good for Russia, you said.
It's not good for Russia eventually. No, but, I mean, in the calculations of power, of course, the United States and China, Russia, then maybe India, then Japan, but Europe is nowhere.
When the Americans talk about the European Union, at least in popular terms, they often say that it's some kind of a peace mechanism that allowed the Europeans to leave and let leave after the two very bloody wars. Do you buy this explanation? And do you think these kind of tensions that we are seeing in Europe...
It is not an American explanation. It is truth.
You believe it's true?
No. A European Union was built on two ideas. One is to end wars. Basically, even one idea, one and a half, to end wars in Europe. The second partially to contain the Soviet Union, but it was, a secondary idea. And they have already achieved these ideas, and that's where they started to disintegrate and dissipate, because when they had an opportunity in the 80s and the 90s to find a new grand idea, they failed because they were lazy.
The enlargement seems like a very good idea. Why wasn't it successful?
No, it was absolutely, it was a recipe for disaster. There were several, they made several huge mistakes. One is enlargement. So too fast, too far. The second was Europe without a central economic leadership. There were other three or four things which they have made because they believed that they were winning, and always it is very dangerous to believe that you're a winner.
Do you think the tensions that we are now seeing among some European countries, the rebellion against the collective action that we see on the part of Italy or sometimes Hungary, is it likely to transform into a real antagonism, a militarized antagonism once again?
Not yet, but I am very much concerned about the general erosion of the European Union, which is long-term. And I hope they will somehow be able to go back to the state of the Union in the 80s and 90s, because if they don't do that, they will start to crumble. And then we'll have a Europe, which we have had for centuries. And that is a terrible idea. Of course, Russia is strong, but Europe, which is fighting or and tension with each other, is and has been through history the quagmire of the world.
I think you would agree with me that Russia would not be able to improve its relationship with Europe without solving the Ukrainian crisis. And you have a very interesting theory of the underlying reasons for it. You believe that that was an attempt to prevent Europe from turning to the east. Is that right?
Ukrainian crisis, is, I think it's not a theory. I think I know it was one of the attempts, I mean, creating a Euro, Ukrainian crisis was an attempt by certain forces within the United States and in Europe. In preventing Europe to go to the east.
That's, that is not a theory. The Ukrainians will disagree with that. They believe that the agency was theirs.
I'm not here. I know these people who did that. Now, Ukraine will be a problem for next couple of decades until it is either it dissolves or the problem is settled between the larger European nations.
One of your colleagues, Dmitry Trenin of the Carnegie Moscow Center, wrote recently that in order to solve the Ukrainian crisis, Russia will have to opt for gathering people instead of gathering lands. His idea is that Russia should offer an expedited path to citizenship for Eastern Ukrainians if they want to, while facilitating the reincorporation of that territory into Ukraine proper. Do you agree with that?
Well, that could be one of the settlements, but one of the elements of the settlement. No, there are others, but I don't think this issue could be settled. It is a long-term, almost civilization issue. And we have in Ukraine a failing state with an elite which is unable to run. And I don't think it could be settled.
And I guess the final question, the collapse of the Soviet Union had a major impact on the Russian psyche. It was humiliation, national humiliation to some extent. But I think it also prompted a great degree of self-reassessment. And in some ways, Russians are more humble, but they are also more realistic. They are more proud in certain ways and rightfully proud of themselves. Do you think that kind of transformation will happen to the West as well? Do you think they will ever abandon their sense of mission?
I hope so, but we are still in the process of rebuilding ourselves, by the way. And the West has not yet failed. So the proposed Western resurrection should be waited for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, but you would agree with that many of our problems are psychological. It's not only strategic disagreements, but also an issue of who can tell what to whom.
Of course, but there were also very basic elements of strategic disagreement. We couldn't have yielded Ukraine to NATO, and it would have been a cause of war. So, looking back and returning to your question, I must say one of the many competitive advantages of Russia, we have weaknesses too, is that we have lived through the failure and the resurrection. I must say we are more cunning, brighter, and open-eyed.
And increasingly more self-confident, I would gather.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Mr. Karaganov, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time. I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.